to Sip for Speech, the podcast for public finance professionals. Despite the awful weather, it's been a busy month here at SIPFA, and we've got a great episode lined up for you today. We'll be speaking to Simon Bottery from the King's Fund about social care reform, and Deborah Garvey from Charity Shelter about homelessness and social housing. But coming up first, we have Angus Peters, editor of Pensions Expert, and SIPFA's own pensions expert, Richard Lloyd Bithell, on the role of public sector pensions in the sustainability agenda.
This is Callahan Hager, and I'm here with pensions expert editor Angus Peters and SIPFA's pensions and treasury management advisor Richard Lloyd Bithell. Thanks both for being here today.
Thank you.
James. Thank you very much.
So as you both are very involved in the world of pensions, we'll go ahead and dive right into our discussion on local government and sustainable investment with pensions. So Angus, to kick things off, can you give us an overview of ESG or sustainable investing and what it means in practical terms to invest sustainably?
Yeah, sure. So ESG is often talked about as being responsible or sustainable investing. That sometimes creates a bit of a confusion with ethical investing. So the idea that you're giving up returns for your members in order to do good in the world, which is not really what ESG is around. And I kind of instead probably characterize ESG as a set of risks. They're long-term risks, so environmental, social, and governance risks. So some examples of that might be how the businesses that a pension fund owns or lends to are impacted by things like climate change, the impact those businesses have on society, and things like how well they're run. So governance factors tend to be things like executive pay, diversity in the workforce, lots of these factors that maybe weren't treated as financially material before, but we actually now know do have an impact on the value of an investment. So what does it mean in practice? It means that your asset managers should be collecting more information from the companies that they invest in, looking for data on how some of these factors might affect their business and how they can improve themselves. And they should be taking some steps to try and improve corporate practices on that. So there's that three-stage process of engagement, telling the company what they think, telling them what they want to see, then using your voting power if you've got it as an equity investor. You own this company, so you have a say in how it's run. And the final stage is divestment. If a company isn't doing anything to mitigate those risks, then some asset managers might no longer be able to justify holding that company.
Right. What are some of the recent developments you've been reporting on specific to sustainable investing by pension schemes in the UK? And I guess take it a bit further, but has this actually been developing concurrently at the same pace in both the public and private sectors?
Yeah, I think it probably has been developing at different paces in the public and private sector. I would say that public sector are probably ahead of the private sector, and I think that's maybe down to scale. And we tend to see that larger pension funds have a bit more resource. They maybe have more in-house investment capabilities where people have been thinking about these issues a bit longer. In terms of the developments, I think we've seen a bit of an intensification of these risks. Clearly, climate change has burst into the public consciousness. But also, I think you've got regulation becoming stricter and stricter. And that kind of works in two ways. So you've got the regulation that applies directly to asset owners like pension funds. And then I suppose you've got another layer of regulation that gives bite to some of those pushes on the asset owner side, and that's really in terms of what the government does to companies. So the example that springs to mind is just recently we had the ban on diesel, petrol and hybrid cars is going to be brought forward to 2035. And that suddenly starts to crystallize some of these long-term, difficult to quantify risks. Instead of being something vague, you suddenly know that car manufacturers in the UK are going to have to dramatically shift their business models by 2035. And that feeds down the investment chain through the asset managers and to the asset owners, ultimately the pension fund.
Right. And so, Richard, just to give our listeners some context, how big is the public sector pension market?
It's important to remember that the local government pension scheme is not a single pension scheme, but it's a combination of over 100 separate funds, ranging from $1 billion in assets to around $20 billion. The combined fund value of the LGPS is around $338 billion. The two largest individual schemes that we have in the UK are Strathclyde and Manchester, which have just over £20 billion in assets. And the smallest ones are around Powys and Shetland.
I think that scale idea is quite important here because it's quite hard to have, A, an impact on what your asset manager does, and be an impact on what a company does. If you're a sub-billion pound fund asking and you're, you know, invested via a pooled fund with an asset manager, or if your asset manager's not got scale. So the more investors are working together, and I think you probably do start to see that in local investment pools, and then you see asset managers working together on resolution.
So there have been 8 asset pools that have been set up with the aim of pooling resources and asset, and also the objective of reducing management fees. But I completely agree with having that combined resource. It's much easier to have an impact on a national policy basis. We often think of it as just being council staff who are in the LGPS. There's also over 10,000 separate employing bodies who are involved in providing public services, and have over 5,000 staff from other companies and other organisations that are involved in the delivery of public services.
So it's not just council workers themselves then?
It can be private companies who are delivering public services, charities, academies. Okay. It's a whole range of stakeholders who are going to be interested and will want to be involved in the ESG conversation.
Building on that point, do local authorities themselves manage the pension scheme? If not, I guess, what does the management structure look like for most schemes of local authorities?
It's a local authority's responsibility to manage the pension fund in the typical case. LGPS funds are not a separate legal entity to local authority, and these are mainly operated by upper tier local authorities, for example, London boroughs, county councils, unitary authorities. It's our operation, and that there's a segregation of duty between the officer and council level who provide financial stewardship for these investments and the administration of the scheme. And it provides that political accountability.
So what you're saying is that local authorities really do actually have a great deal of influence in kind of sparking the ESG shift.
Absolutely. It's important for local authorities to ensure that they are empowered to make these decisions and drive their local policy forward. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Welsh Assembly Member Pension Fund has committed to completely divesting from fossil fuels. But I think we will see more examples of that going forward.
It's quite an interesting debate, that idea of divestment versus engagement. And clearly there's a lot of powerful campaign groups around that really require only divestment. So things like Extinction Rebellion, there's another group called Fossil Free. The investment community seems to be more focused around engagement as a way of improving companies' behaviours, in that saying, you know, we're not going to make oil companies disappear overnight. Frankly, we still need them because we don't have completely green infrastructure. But I agree there's only going to be more pressure to divest if it becomes clear that engagement isn't working.
And Angus, you report on these issues all the time. At the end of last year, we saw over 1/2 of all the UK local authorities declare climate emergency. So how integral do you think either a divestment strategy or an environmentally conscious investment strategy is for councils in order to actually meet their plans?
Yeah, I think it's really important. You can maybe start to look at some of these ESG issues as well as opportunities rather than risk. And that is where we start to move away from ESG and more towards what's known as impact investing, where you're not looking up to give up returns, but you are looking to have a positive impact on society around you. And it's for those reasons that you see local authority pension funds investing in things like social housing, in renewable energy infrastructure, things which kind of prepare the UK and sometimes even in the backyard of that local authority fund, which help us adapt towards a greener future, more sustainable future.
So logistically speaking, how big of a challenge is this investment shift?
I think the logistical challenge is it's not insignificant, but it's not insurmountable either. So I guess you have a challenge in asset owners, so councils, trustees in the private sector, educating themselves. They then have to start collecting more information, so really challenging advisors and asset managers on what they're doing to analyse these risks and then combat them. And I guess part of that is how to see through greenwashing by asset managers, which is this accusation that some managers pay lip service to ESG risk, but they don't really do anything about it. So it's funny, as a journalist, when you go and interview people, asset managers will say, oh, we've been doing ESG for decades. And they all say that, despite actually when you go back and find out 10 years ago, there was a handful of them that were properly talking about it. We are starting to see more change on that. So you had BlackRock, US investment giant, signed up to the Climate Action 100 Plus initiative a few weeks ago, which was a big change. I think the other challenge is that we'd like to see more standardisation of how you quantify ESG risks and how asset asset managers can show what they've done. I think the more questions you ask, the better. And then the final logistical challenge is cost. So ESG variants of funds do tend to cost more. There has been this criticism from some people that the asset management industry is using ESG as a way to prop up its fee revenue. And you definitely see plenty of active managers in particular using ESG as their kind of big next marketing tool. But I don't think that should necessarily stop you from taking action on these risks if you do believe that they are material risks.
The key one from a CIPFA perspective is the upskilling of both officers and decision makers who are involved in making these investment decisions and setting out the strategy. I know from the CIPFA Pensions Network that is our main objective for the year, to upskill both officers and members in being able to A, identify the opportunities and also recognise the risks of ESG investment.
Yeah, I suppose you might look to some of the examples set by the bigger players as well. So we were talking, weren't we, about the Brunel pension pool, which has kind of set out a pretty detailed manifesto on climate change specifically, but is active on a wide range of ESG issues. They've set themselves targets on disclosure, on policy lobbying, on how they want to see changes take place in their portfolio. So I think they want to see something like a 7% reduction in carbon emissions in their portfolio year on year. And they're kind of saying to asset managers, if this isn't happening, then you need to start divesting from some companies.
7%, that's pretty significant.
It's quite year on year. It's a pretty ambitious target.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting benchmark to set, and it'll be interesting to see how other asset pools and funds respond off the back of that.
All in all, it seems like it's a pretty manageable task for local authorities to shift their investment strategy. Turning to the decision-making side of that equation, Richard, how has the management and governance of pension schemes in the public sector changed over the past few years?
Well, I think the biggest shift we've seen is, as we've spoken about, asset pools, funds moving towards pooling assets. An interesting change in governance and roles adds an additional layer of governance involved in the sector and different dynamic for decision-making as well. Several changes that have happened over the last couple of years. Initiatives on good governance, how the models of pension schemes actually operate, how separate they should be from their administering local authority. Also, transparency around the governance arrangements. As a key, the standards and the practice that is expected of decision makers. And it's really those key individuals on boards who can bring their knowledge and expertise to the table and support officers in ensuring that decision is A, transparent, and B, justifiable in the current climate.
So are there any local government initiatives or regulations in place already to help or force authorities to facilitate their investment shift?
Well, the UK government hasn't imposed any requirements on ethical investment, but it does require full disclosure in the statement of investment principles on the pension fund's policy on social, environmental, and ethical investments when considering the selection and retention and realisation of investments.
Just adding on to that, it wouldn't surprise me if we see target setting intensify some more this year. You know, we've got the COP26 UN summit in Glasgow this year. There's a possibility that nations and then I suppose local authorities might start to set some slightly more stretching targets on reducing our environmental impact. And that can then start to feed through to regulations that apply to sectors, which then give investors some pretty concrete things to think about.
So last but not least, what do you think the future holds for public sector pension schemes?
I think, turning maybe away slightly from ESG stuff, that there might be a bit more pressure on benefits. You know, on the funded side, the local government pension scheme's got its valuation underway, and some of the factors are easing a little bit. You've got longevity improvements are slowing down, which is making funding defined benefit schemes a little bit easier. But you also have some legal cases, things like a court judgment called McLeod, which was really influential on the way that public sector pension schemes are run, and that could increase costs. There's also a bit of pressure on the actuaries, the people that value local authority pension schemes, to standardise their approach a bit. And I guess the other thing that we might see further into the future is greater consolidation. So pooling is really only just kicked off. We'll be going for quite a long time. But I wonder whether we might start to see more shared services on the administration side.
I completely agree. So I think that pooling is still in its infancy, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops in terms of cost saving, how much saving is actually realised, but only time will tell on that, really.
All right, thank you both for your thoughts today.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
fascinating stuff there, and thank you to both Angus and Richard for joining us on this month's episode. Coming up next, we have Simon Bottery from the King's Fund. I went to speak to Simon about the King's Fund's research on social care reform and what needs to be done to bring about meaningful change. I'm here with Simon Bottery from the King's Fund. How are you, Simon?
I'm very well, thank you.
So tell us a bit about yourself, Simon. How long have you been with the King's Fund? What's your background?
So I've been at the fund for just over 2 years now. I started off a long time ago working in journalism and PR, and then I moved into the charity sector. As part of that, got into policy, particularly as regards older people, and part of that got into social care. I'm the senior fellow in social care, so my job is to try and understand as much about the broad trends in social care as anybody, I guess.
Social care is very much the hot topic across the entire political spectrum. The issues in social care cut across funding, workforce, demand, but let's kick off with the issue of quality. So in a piece that you wrote fairly recently, you mentioned that the CQC suggests that care quality is improving, but that the local government ombudsman highlighted complaints are becoming more severe in their nature. So quality is quite nebulous, it means different things to different people. What do you see as the issues impacting care quality? What does good look like?
Well, quality is a fascinating one. So we started off by looking at it in terms of what do the big numbers say. And there are two interesting numbers for social care quality. One is around provider performance, and the second one is around what do people who receive publicly funded social care, what do they think of the quality of what they receive. On provider quality, as you say, the CQC numbers show a small improvement over the last 3 years or so since they changed the inspection regime. It would suggest that the majority of providers are either good or outstanding with relatively small numbers and requires improvement. See a similar trend really with satisfaction. You see very, very high numbers of people saying that they're very satisfied. If you just looked at the numbers and nothing else, you would go, well, everything is great, so we can sort of not worry about that sector at all. We can think about something else. But we did a round table here not so long ago over a glass of wine about what they thought about quality in social care. And for me, the really interesting thing was that people absolutely expect the numbers to be right. They expect that the provider should be safe and people should turn up on time. There were some real basics that were absolute givens. But when they got into the conversation about quality, it was much more about how people were made to feel. And the examples that people were coming up with were much more about how individual reactions to circumstances. So the bad example was someone saying that a relative had come to visit them in hospital and a nurse had refused the relative admittance because it was a lunch break, and that was given as a really bad example of poor quality. And the good example was someone saying that they'd needed care, but the social worker would come and see them once every sort of 2 or 3 days in order to have the initial conversation about what they wanted. But the state this person was in, they said, I would always just tell them to go away, and often tell them to go away in no uncertain terms. And it was only after months of this person coming and coming back and building up a relationship that she was able to come through the door and they were able to have a conversation, and that transformed that person's life. The numbers, I think, only tell you some things, and the sense of what does quality look like in terms of the way that people perceive what's happening to them, that's much more intangible. And it led me very much to think about trying to have an ear open for stories and what people are saying about services as well.
So those stories, from what you're saying, sounds like they swing less on the numbers and far more on notions of independence, compassion.
Yeah, compassion is a word that came up a lot, and I think it makes quite a lot of sense. It is this sort of quite subjective sense of how I feel about something. And I had a really interesting discussion on Twitter recently where there was a local authority and they collect and count the number of complaints they receive about social care every year, but they also collect and count the number of compliments that they receive. And there was an interesting conversation with providers and other people on Twitter about how many people collected compliments. And quite a lot of people said, oh yes, of course we do. But my sense was that we probably are more inclined to analyse complaints and try and identify trends in complaints and what went wrong than we are to analyse compliments in the sense of, well, what did we do right?
Yeah, there is a very sort of human sense of focusing on the negative. I imagine many people see that in their personal as well as professional lives. One of the other aspects in the paper that you wrote was around equity of access to social care, the fact that it's a bit of a postcode lottery, it's variable across the country. Something that came up a few times in the most recent election debate was that people are having to sell their homes to pay for care. Are there solutions to this?
Of course there are. There's very few policy issues for which there isn't some degree of a solution. The issue about selling homes to pay for care is really a symptom of a much much wider problem. I mean, the reason that people end up paying large amounts of money is because a large number of people have no access to publicly funded social care in the first place. And that's either because their needs are considered to be too low or their assets are too high. And I try and explain the process in social care as being you have to be a pole vaulter, because you've got to demonstrate that your needs are above a certain point. You've got to get over the bar, the needs bar, in order to get access to publicly funded social care. But you've also got to be a limbo dancer, because you've got to get under the bar, which is about the level of assets. And so you've got to be a pole vaulter and a limbo dancer if you want to access publicly funded social care. And the issue is there are too many people who can't do that, either because their needs or their assets don't meet the requirements. They end up paying for their care. And then some of those people, let's say 1 in 10, go on to pay, you know, what are often called catastrophic costs of over £100,000. But although that is an issue in its own right, and clearly it's wrong that people face those catastrophic costs, it is a symptom of this wider issue that too many people just simply don't get access to publicly funded care in the first place.
So is that a funding issue or a criteria issue or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. I think what we should be looking for is a lot more people being able to get free or subsidised social care and not having to pay all of the costs themselves. And then you do want to make sure that some people don't end up paying very large amounts, because one of the big issues with the need for social care, particularly in later life, is that neither you nor I nor anybody listening to this podcast can know how much care they're going to need at some stage in their life. None of us will know whether we're going to develop dementia, whether we're going to develop a severe physical disability that requires a great deal of care. Even though we can't know it, and therefore we can't logically save because we know that's what it's going to cost us, nor can we insure ourselves against the cost of it because there are no commercial products or very few commercial products available. So you have to have some form of risk pooling whereby we're all contributing towards the cost, and then people who need that very high level of care have it met out of some sort of public funds.
I suppose that's the challenge with adult social care in particular, the aspect of modelling demand, the fact that you could find yourself in a position at any point in your life where you may require care, whether that's short-term and acute or long-term and chronic. Challenging situation. One of the other areas that you've referenced in some of your writings was around the sort of fragility of the social care market in general, which sort of is another compounding factor. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
You know, if you could identify one factor that's causing most of many of the problems, it would be around funding. Funding and related issues contribute to a situation where social care is unusual. It's unlike the NHS as we know. The great majority of it is delivered by private sector providers commissioned by local authorities. What we do know is that the rates that local authorities pay for social care are below what, perhaps unsurprisingly, below what providers say they need. But I think most people would recognise that below the optimum rate, a rate that allows providers to provide the sort of quality of care that's needed and to make sure that there's a sustainable pool of people in the marketplace, you know, willing and able to provide services. What we're seeing is more local authorities seeing providers either hand back contracts or go out of business. We see providers who decide that, well, actually they'll focus their business entirely on the self-funder market where they can get higher rates rather than local authorities where the numbers that they receive aren't enough. And you do also see difficulties in particular parts of the countries where local authorities find it hard to find providers. So if I'm in a rural area and I'm a provider, the cost of delivery of my service may well be higher because there's more travel time. And the other factor for providers is workforce. We don't have enough social care workers at any one time, 122,000 vacancies. And the gap between the number that we need and the number we've got appears to be growing year on year. And part of that inevitably is related to money. We don't pay care workers anything like the amount that we should do if we were looking at the role in terms of the sort of skills that's required of it. And crucially, we pay less than sectors like retail. Virtually every single major supermarket in England is paying more on average for its staff than the average price paid for the average rate received by a care worker. So all of these things are related to this issue of funding and the amount of money that's going into the system, and that's the system, that's the problem that's bedeviled the sector for the last sort of 20 or 30 years at least.
So I suppose on that issue of funding, it's where a lot of the issues tend to come back to. So the ultimate question is, how do we pay for it? You referenced risk pooling earlier. Where does the money come from? Ultimately, there's the inevitable political challenge of having to convince the populace that this is something that effectively we'd have to pay more tax for.
Well, we need to reform the system system. We need to make it a more generous system with wider eligibility, and that will cost more money. And then we need to properly fund that system. And the history is the current system of narrower eligibility, we're not funding that adequately at the moment. So we need a reform system, and we need it funded, you know, more adequately for the responsibilities that it places on local authorities in particular to deliver services. Yes, that's going to cost more money. And I think one of the issues has been that social care, adult social care, in comparison to the number of people in the population, the number of service users is relatively small. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that it's not had the profile in other areas. And if you went back 10 years, you would talk to MPs about this being an issue, and they would say, yeah, we completely agree with you, but this isn't an issue which is turning up in my post bag. But I think that is actually starting to change, partly because the demand is clearly there. People are, you know, recognise that there is more demand for local authorities to cope with. Also because, you know, we've had a period since about 2010 of putting less money into social care. That started to bottom out in about 2014-15, but we're still not back up to the levels in real terms that we were in 2010. So in a way, we've created a crisis by underfunding in social care, and I think people are picking up on that as well. So it is changing. We are recognising that it is more of a priority, and I think we're sort of getting closer to the point that governments recognise that we are going to have to put more money in.
Obviously, this isn't a quick fix. There's no solution to it that's going to be turned around, I don't know, in the next year. But then, of course, as part of his election campaign, Boris pledged to fix social care. In a recent interview with the BBC, he mentioned it could take 5 years or so he's kind of backpedaled on that a little bit. Suffice to say, it's going to take more than political rhetoric to make the change you're describing happen. So what are the first steps, I suppose, given that the challenge could possibly seem insurmountable?
I don't think it is insurmountable, but I suppose, like the elephant, you probably shouldn't attempt to eat it all in one go. There are some clear issues that need to be addressed in policy terms. And actually, we know what those issues are, and broadly, we know the sorts of solutions out there. So as a piece of analysis and a piece of decision-making, it's not necessarily that complicated. I do think it makes sense, though, and I hope the government picks up on this, that whatever we think of as the potential policy solution, whichever of the options we go down, we do actually spend some time to sort of consult and talk about it, not just with providers, but also I think ideally we want a broader discussion with the public, because ultimately they're going to be the ones, you know, that actually benefit and use services. So I think it's worth taking a little bit of time once you've decided in ideal terms which policy direction you're going in, to spend some time to get that policy solution right, and then recognise that it may take time to implement and roll out. And again, there are some clear sort of obvious policy solutions to the issues around eligibility, for example. But if we go back to something like quality, or we go back to integration and how you join up services, although there are things you can do in those areas, those sorts of solutions don't come overnight. So those will be about practice and about culture. We do need this sustained period of work and a sustained programme of work to actually make improvements in those areas as well.
So you talked there about the importance of consultation, both with suppliers, local authorities, the public. Obviously, we've been waiting quite a while for a social care green paper. Then there was the announcement that we'll be skipping the green paper altogether and jumping straight to a white paper. There's certainly been a bit of concern that I've been hearing about kind of getting, like, jumping the gun a little bit effectively and skipping that sort of consensus building exercise. How do you feel about that particular policy decision?
Well, that's why I say I think it is important to have that consultation process. I don't think we need to sort of say, well, we're starting from blank sheet of paper, we've got no idea what we could be doing, give us your ideas. We know what the fundamental problems are, and we know broadly what the options are. You then need to spend the time to make sure you make the right decisions, and then that you implement it correctly. People have got time to make those decisions. So I definitely would be concerned if we said, okay, we've got a solution and we're trying to implement it tomorrow. Equally, we don't need to be sitting here in sort of 2 or 3 years' time, go, well, we've had this long consultation exercise and now this is what we're thinking about. There's a happy medium between those two things. So what the government have talked about, which is, you know, essentially having decisions by the end of this year with a solution implemented within this parliament, given the history of social care and the history of failure to get reform done, then if that were to happen and it were a good solution, clearly that would be a win.
So reason to be optimistic then?
You know, I always say if you're going to work in social care, you've got to be an optimist, because it's not a territory which has given a huge amount of encouragement always over the last couple of decades to the people who work in it. So you have to have a degree of optimism, but probably there are more grounds for optimism now than there have been.
Well, it's lovely to end on a positive note. So thank you very much, Simon, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Sip for Speaks. Some really interesting thoughts there from Simon. It would seem that the roadmap to reform in some ways is very clear, but only time will tell whether government will be able to build consensus around much-needed changes. Lastly, this episode, we're joined by Deborah Garvey from the charity Shelter to explore the impact of homelessness, both on communities and individuals, as well as on the public purse.
I'm Kate Latimer, and I'm joined by Deborah Garvey, Policy Manager at Shelter. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and the kind of work you are involved with at Shelter?
I've worked at Shelter for 20 years, so I've worked on a full range of housing policy over that time, but the biggest focus at the moment is homelessness and people in temporary accommodation and housing benefit levels.
And just to start sort of quite generally, so we're currently in the midst of a national housing emergency. What do you believe has been kind of the main causes for this?
That's a very simple explanation, and that is lack of access to affordable homes. And the underlying cause of that is a chronic shortage of social rented housing. Also, there's been a net loss of social rent homes. So for example, just over 6,000 social rent homes were delivered last year, but at the same time, nearly 24,000 were sold or demolished. So there was a net reduction of nearly 17,500 homes in England. That's in 2018-19. We're actually hemorrhaging social rent homes as well as not building enough to keep up with changes in need. And then the second problem is inadequate levels of housing benefit, and particularly housing benefit for people who rent privately. We've seen a series of restrictions and freezes to local housing allowance, starting from 2012 when there was a one-year freeze, and then in 2013 they were uprated by the Consumer Price Index, which doesn't consider rent inflation. Then in 2014 and 15, the rates only rose by 1%, which was lower than the rate of rental inflation. And then in 2016, a four-year freeze was announced, and that means that that freeze is ending this April. But in that period since 2012, rents as a whole have increased by 15%, and in some areas, in fact many areas, they've risen faster than that. The local housing allowance rate has only increased by around 6% in that same period. It's pretty clear that as a result of that, people are really, really struggling to pay their rent, and it's now 1.4 million households who claim local housing allowance to meet either all or some of their housing costs. 500,000 of those are in work. This is working families who are having to claim local housing allowance to bridge the gap between their low earnings and ever-increasing rents. Our analysis has shown that as a result of that series of restrictions and freezes, it's now in 97% of areas in England, you're going to have a shortfall between your local housing allowance and rents in the bottom third of the market, which is what local housing allowance is supposed to cover. The fact that people can't access social rented housing and then increasingly can't access a private rental has led to this really, really serious emergency.
You say that the three main aims you have is to unfreeze the LHA, get a social housing bill and end Section 21. So what do you think that the government should do in the current climate to make this happen?
First of all, to increase capital investment in social rent housing. That's the most efficient way to ensure that people who can't afford market rents can access an affordable home, because that way, you know, the money that they pay in rents is obviously going back into the public finances, but also it means that people don't, you know, have to be claiming housing benefit in order to cover their rent with the bill going ever upwards. Even though we need the investment now, in the meantime, we do need local housing allowance rates to go back to where government policy said they should be, which was the bottom third of the private rental market. And then in terms of the abolition of Section 21, which for people that don't know, this is no-fault evictions. If you rent privately, you're usually given a fixed term tenancy, and when that fixed term has expired, the landlord, provided they've served you with the correct legal notices, can seek possession of your home without you having done anything wrong. We're really, really pleased that the government has acknowledged the impact that's having, and so in the Queen's speech they've promised a renters reform bill and committed to abolish Section 21. The important thing will be that it really does ensure that people can't be evicted through no fault of their own, that even for example, if the landlord argues that they need to sell the property, there should still be safeguards to ensure tenants aren't evicted.
And I know you mentioned before about temporary accommodation. And what would you say were the main factors at play when considering the financial strain on other local government services as well?
What we've seen is really big rises in all forms of homelessness. So since 2010, statutory homelessness has increased by 29%, but the number of households living in temporary accommodation increased by 74% since 2010, and then rough sleeping has increased by 165% and by 94% in the last 5 years alone. So what most people don't see and aren't aware of is families in temporary accommodation, as private landlords have pulled out of the local housing allowance sector because increasingly people claiming local housing allowance is not going to cover the rent. And certainly if you want to increase the rent each year, the freeze to local housing allowance has meant that, you know, it's quite likely that the tenant might end up in rent arrears. So landlords have been wary, increasingly wary, to let to claimants, that instead they've been enticed by temporary accommodation brokers. The local authority have the same problem. Very few social housing units available and very difficult to find an affordable private rental. So they're desperate for accommodation, and brokerage companies have set up in the last kind of 10 years. They are increasingly charging nightly rates. Previously, the council would only be charged a nightly rate if they were using a budget hotel chain or some kind of bed and breakfast. But increasingly, nightly rates are being charged for what is really a kind of room in a shared house or a self-contained flat, and that's how the brokers are making their profit. So it's over $1 billion a year being spent by councils in England on temporary accommodation. A lot of it is very, very poor conditions. So whilst the law says that if you have children you shouldn't be in B&B for more than 6 weeks, the definition of a B&B is where it's a private owner and you're sharing facilities, so you're sharing either toilet, bathroom, kitchen facilities. What we're seeing is accommodation being developed which is called self-contained, but it's actually one very small room with a tiny shower room and a little kitchenette. It might not be quite that bad, but it still means all the other problems, which is living in one room, eating, sleeping. If you have young children, it means once they're in bed at 7 in the evening, you know, you've got to sit in the dark all night, which means then if you've also got teenagers who are trying to study, can't have any visitors really, because people are literally doing everything, sleeping on the bed, eating their food on the bed, or sometimes even on the floor. So it's just really intolerable conditions. People might think, oh, this is temporary accommodation, it's only for a very short amount of time, but we're seeing families in this sort of accommodation for months, you know, over a year, 18 months, really pushing families to breaking point.
Yeah, and of course, as you know, you're saying, it's a very temporary solution to a long-term problem, and you are going to have the strain on other services like, you know, mental health services, addiction recovery, because the main cause of the problem hasn't been solved.
That's right. And I think we have to be aware that if this continues, some of the accommodation is so unsafe that if a fire were to break out, that we could be looking at another disaster.
So there have been quite a few highly controversial measures that have happened in the UK to reduce rough sleeping, such as the use of hostile architecture in big cities, which reduce the appearance of homelessness instead of actually tackling the issue. Why do you think there's been a lack of a long-term strategy when it comes to this?
The government have published a rough sleeping strategy. There are funding initiatives attached to that, and it does seem to be where the funding has been focused. There have been reductions in the number of street homeless people, although it's not going down anywhere near as much as it's gone up the last 5-10 years. But we would like to see a national cross-government strategy. We haven't been building enough social rent homes, and particularly specialist social rent housing, as I've said, sheltered housing and maybe disabled access and so on. Good councils work together, and they've been required since the early 2000s to work strategically to prevent homelessness. So, and councils do a very good job on the whole of reviewing every, they have to review every 5 years what are the major causes of homelessness in our area, then to strategically make sure that they're addressing those main causes, and councils generally carry out those reviews very well. The problem is that they can't often do much about it. And so we're saying that that same requirement should happen at a national level. So the new homeless legislation that came in 2017, the Homelessness Reduction Act, that did place a duty on other public bodies to refer people that they're working with who they believe might be threatened with homelessness to the local housing authority. We would like to see the money going into genuine prevention, which is local housing allowance rates, and that means a whole load of people who are at the moment having to go to their local authority, having to fall onto the state, being able to self-serve in the market, whereas at the moment they just can't find anywhere, having to go to the council, and then you're having to take whatever you're offered in terms of temporary accommodation with no choices whatsoever.
We've got the budget coming up in March, and at SIPFA we've been calling for a much longer term planning horizon for local government. What would you say would be the ideal outcomes from the budget?
It's to address the things that I've outlined throughout, which are the structural causes of the housing emergency. So we'd like the government to commit first and foremost to increasing capital investment in social rent housing. And then the second thing is that the local housing allowance rates must be restored to where government policy said they should be, which is at least the bottom third of rents. We'd like to see them bottom half of rents, but even the bottom third would do an awful lot to reduce homelessness. Councils have really stepped up to the challenge of the new legislation by and large. They've really sort of changed their ways of working in most cases, and we're seeing people treated with a lot more dignity now. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of that, there's no home to help them into.
Great, well, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Deborah Garvey for sharing her thoughts on such an urgent and emotive issue. And of course, thank you to all of our speakers for joining us this episode. That's about all we've got time for. Join us next month, where we'll be hearing from one of last year's Public Finance Award winners ahead of April's 2020 awards dinner, as well as the Institute for Public Policy Research and SIPFA's CEO, Rob Whiteman. That's all for now. See you next time.